All right, we're in part two of the lecture.
So often I do this, I just get what I consider to be the key sections of the reading and just go through them and amplify them, if you like. But with Maturana, I usually amplify a philosopher, and they usually... Maturana is a bit more self-explicating, I think. So he's presenting... not a philosophical position in an obvious sense. It's a scientific hypothesis. But in a way, in the background, there's a certain philosophical view that he holds that you have to dig quite deeply into his writing. I'm presenting it as... I'm forgetting Gerda Verdenzoller and presenting it as Maturana's work, but that's because I know his name so well. But as I do this, I'd like you all to bear in mind that there's a whole perspective that this German child psychologist has brought to what he says that's totally transformed his earlier writing. So it's clear he's written it, but it's her ideas, I think, that he's expressing here. So the... at the beginning of the reading, for those of you who haven't done it, there was he talks about Franz de Waal, I think was his name, a South African, quite a famous researcher in primate behaviour, and he did a long term study in behaviour of chimpanzees in a large zoo, but he's quite famous for his studies of the bonobos. I don't know if you know about the bonobos.
Yeah.
They're quite significant to this, even though Maturana doesn't mention them. So they're a part of the chimpanzee lineage that split off in the Congo, I think, that behave quite differently to chimpanzees. I'm surprised Maturana doesn't use the bonobos as well, because they too have a very different social dynamic to the chimpanzees.
There's a river that splits them.
Yeah. It's the Congo, isn't it?
Yeah.
Unless
between
that's been...
the bonobo and the chimpanzee.
Yes.
And the bonobo, they're so loving and they're always having sex.
Yeah.
No, I did a little bit on that. They're not always having sex. They don't... their birth rates are similar to the chimpanzees. And the females can be quite vicious. Have been known to bite off various parts of the male body. we won't go into the bonobos today because it's not part of the reading. So the finding of Franz de Waal was essentially that chimpanzees live in a way that he interpreted as quite similar to the way that we live, essentially in an atmosphere of mistrust, where the dynamics are all about competition and domination and submission, which it doesn't go into. It would be essentially around who gets to mate with who, you know, that's what a lot of this kind of Darwinian way of living is about. It's about whose genetic inheritance gets to go to the next generation. And the whole thinking of that is that if it wasn't for that, then we'd all become... we wouldn't be... We'd die out. Anything that isn't suited to survival doesn't survive, so it's not here. Do you know, it's a self-sustaining argument. You know, if there were, the argument sort of goes, if there were loving, cooperative animals in the past, then they would have died out because they would have been outcompeted by species like the chimpanzees. So in a way, at the very beginning, he's asking this question. He's saying, well, the chimpanzees are like this, and many of the other primate species are like this. But he's saying notwithstanding the fact that in our culture we look like we exhibit a lot of these features, he wants to say, and I shall quote,
that the fundament of human living is love, and that cooperation in humans arises through the pleasure of doing things together in mutual trust, not through the manipulation of relations. We do not say that love is the only emotion under which we human beings live, but we claim that it can be argued biologically, that we are the kind of beings that we are because love has been the emotion that has grounded the course of the evolutionary history that gave origin to us. So here, I think it's quite important that we look into what... I hesitate over saying what love is. I think we have to look into what is meant by love here. Right? So, and in a way, you have to sort of pick that up by through the reading. Maturana doesn't give an in-depth kind of phenomenological description of this is love. And I think in our culture, certainly for me, nobody sat me down when I was a teenager and said, John, this is love. Do you see? Do you understand? This is love. So the point where I said, oh, that's love. You know, people would say they love me, but I wasn't quite sure what that meant. And I realised that I was supposed to love other people as well. I wasn't quite sure what that meant either. There was definitely a word there. And then there was my own, immediate experience of... and then there's all the stuff, you know, in the movies about what love is. And then there's falling in love. And then there's your next door neighbour, you know, and it says your Christmas card, love George, you know, just George. I don't think George loves me. Do you know? it's as a word for us. I don't think we can skate over it and say, oh yeah, we all know what love is. So that's, I mean, in a way, that's a question for this lecture. We're not going to go in what does love mean. I feel that could be another course. I'm not sure I'm ready to teach that yet. I'm not sure I'm capable of teaching that. But I'm interested in what Maturana means here, right? Because he means something biological. So he's interested, I mean, I can say in advance, he's interested in loving behaviour, which is easier to define, I think, than what love itself might be essentially. So, this is just factual stuff in a way, kind of condensed for our benefit, you know, for those of us who are professional biologists, and I'm certainly not. So animals in general, mammals in particular, move in their relations between two extremes. One of mutual respect, trust and body acceptance and nearness, and the other in dynamics of domination and submission. So you've got there's a very clear binary distinction that he wants to make here. And he's basically saying that we move in this place of trust and closeness in our childhood. That it's something that all mammals more or less exhibit to their young, to their offspring. And that the competitive behaviours start to be manifest as soon as you reach sexual maturity. So, I mean, for us that's adolescence, but basically if you come of age to be capable of reproduction, then this other form of aggressive, dominant, submissive behaviour kicks in, especially in the males. So we're just giving a kind of a caricature in a way, a high-level caricature of mammalian behaviour. And the story that Maturana is giving in the reading, which is, I feel I should go slide by slide. I have a great temptation to tell you the whole story all at once, but we'll stick with the slide by slide. Is that the lineages diverged, because we had common ancestors, but it was more than 3 million years ago. Later on he's going to signify about 3 million years ago was the point where something more identifiably human started to emerge. That the key difference, forgetting genetics and everything else, is the different emphasis of our behaviours. And the whole story of the book really is that what human beings have done, or our lineage has done, is that we've conserved and expanded this space of intimacy that's formed in childhood into our adult lives. That what happens generally in the development of mammal species is that there is this openness and cooperation, the necessary openness and cooperation, you know, for biological reasons, because the offspring need a longer time to develop, to get to maturity before they can survive on their own. You know, there are very good biological reasons for that. The whole story in the reading is that, yeah, but what's happened for us is that we've expanded that out into our adult lives. And again, you know, in the reading that I've given you, you don't get the rest of the book. I mean, the rest of the book, in the way, is about to say, but what happened to us? You know, if that's true, you know, what's happening in Iran? Do you know? So I'd like you to hold back the response which says, well, if that's true, then how come we're living like we are? And if I'd like to give you an example, I'd like to give you an example of, well, what about now? Why are we here? A Darwinian may well come in here and says, "Well, you're just satisfying John's urge for domination right now." It could be seen that way, couldn't it?
Or language, language, language and culture about the exchange of ideas.
Yes, I mean, I would say if you look right now, you forgetting the news, forgetting how our society is organised, forgetting Boris Johnson and the whole of the rest of it, why are we here, right? What's FUB about? What's the free university about?
I think we're here to get nourished, you know, by information.
Yeah, but we're not here under coercion, and we're not competing with each other for anything.
That's a very rare thing, which is a free thing, which is good.
Yeah.
Well, we have a biological, some would say we have a biological kind of some endorphins or something.
Yeah, yeah.
Gets now because we all sit here and feeling good about ourselves and we're learning and expanding our consciousness.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, we believe in this.
Yeah, but he's basically saying the chimps don't do this.
No, they don't.
Right?
But
the chimps don't do this.
I think it escapes the observers because the observer want to impose this assertion that, like, it's nothing but domination. I think the chimpanzees, they also have this loving relationship. So I don't know, I haven't observed them, but I think they do have it.
Well, the conclusion... So it's not that we're not capable of that kind of behaviour, and it's not that the chimpanzees aren't capable of... more loving, cooperative behaviour. It's to do with the general atmosphere in which we live, the dominant atmosphere in which we live, to which you might say the dominant atmosphere of our society does look very much more like a chimpanzee form of living. And I guess there's bits missing here in the reading, which is along the lines of things changed a lot with the advent of agricultural civilization. In the picture that Maturana's giving here, we're looking at a lineage going back 3 million years. And we're looking at agricultural society becoming predominant 10,000 years ago. So although it looks like it does now, if we're looking back in biological timescales, we're looking at a mode of living that we predominantly lived for the majority of the time that we were the species that we are. And we shouldn't assess ourselves entirely on the way things are now. Although the way things are now is a source of deep concern to us, And that's partly why the Free University is here too. It's an expression of that concern, isn't it? It's an expression of my concern about how that culture of dominance and submission and competition has utterly infected the university system. Where I don't want to get upset about it, but you're basically buying a product to help you go out in the world and compete more effectively with the people who don't have such a good product. Hence, you want to go to Oxford and Cambridge because that's a real product. Trump's yours. Do you know that's? Is
that's
that it?
That's what you told.
Yeah. It's not just that you got a better education. It's that you met the son of the family that's already running the country.
Yeah.
You know, we all know how it works.
But
that's chimpanzee society, right? And I say, don't get me started. And what are the public schools for? They are to utterly destroy a certain mode of being. I mean, historically, and there's some kind of. I don't think they're as bad as they once were, but they were a place to enforce a kind of a chimpanzee mentality.
To destroy people's empathy, weren't they?
So yeah.
They could go out and
run the empire. Yeah, you can't go out and run the empire if your heart's all bleeding down your shirt. You know, which is, you know, basically, you get, that's what the public school's for, to beat that out of you. You know, the institutions are all there. Why would we need such institutions? Well, because there's something else here, right? Essentially, that needed to be got rid of in order for us to adapt ourselves to the kind of world that we live in. But we're taking a biological perspective here, right? Going back now, and saying, well. The kind of way that we live now, you know, in that time scale, and if we think of the Industrial Revolution, it's they do that, it's 24 hours long, the history of the Earth. We're in the last second where this has occurred. You know, we can take some sustenance from that, in a way. You know, I know our entire lifetime has been lived in this kind of civilization, but certainly. In a bigger time scale, we haven't always lived this way.
I think that it's what you know, not who you know.
Depends
they
where.
Go,
it's the other.
Because they go like, it's not what you know, it's who you know. Like, who you walk with, who you sit with, how important they are in the ladder.
That's what John was saying.
Yeah. That's right. Yeah, but at the same time, I worked as a gardener once, and I was hired by somebody who went to Winchester. You know, and he did. If you've had a proper public school education, you can just put someone down.
Yeah.
So easy. Do you know? You're trained in how to say, no, I don't think I'm superior. But I just can't help it by the way that I speak and act. You know, it's so ingrained. It's quite incredible.
But we were talking about language before being more than words.
Yes.
And I noticed in South Africa, because it happens the other way around, someone would walk in with a posh accent into a hotel, and straight away everyone would ignore the people in front of them and deal with this tall person behind who had a particular accent, deference. So we're doing that in small ways as well to keep this dynamic going.
Yeah, no, I mean, I have to front up about running the class. You know, for that period of my life where I was just an odd jobbing gardener, you know, I was not like nobody. And I decided at a certain point I'd go back to university, you know, just because I was interested in doing it. The day I first walked into my first class and delivered a lecture, I thought, what's happened? You know, almost yesterday I was nobody, and now everybody thinks I know something. do you know the whole background, way you're treated?
Yeah.
It's very, very subtle. And admittedly, you've got to demonstrate you're not a total idiot. But you don't have to be very good to get that kind of, you know, and suddenly you get a whole sort of, I'm somebody. Oh, yes, I'm definitely, everybody else thinks I am, so I must be. Do you know, the whole thing is very...
Everybody agreeing on
who
someone is.
But do you know, it was already in place in that room when I, because I was thinking, how am I going to carry this off, right? How am I, and immediately I thought, no, everybody's treating me as if I'm a lecturer, which meant I was. Do you know? It's.
I've got another example of this kind of power relations we're talking about, and it was my branch secretary, because I work in a union 3 days a week, and the branch secretary, lovely lady, she's been doing this for 30 years now. But right at the beginning, she worked in a care home, and the manager of that care home would treat her in a certain way. Basically, I'm the manager, you're here just to do the job, and didn't go beyond saying hello and goodbye, and that was it. Then she became the rep for the actual institution where she was. The manager's tone turned completely, because then, in terms of those power relations, felt that he had to accommodate that person. And it goes that there is... It doesn't rely on... It's not based on anything, really. It's just kind of sense.
Yeah.
It's just...
It's a shift
that people would do.
There's a certain... Because there's a certain level in me where you think, oh, yeah... A really person with integrity is the same with everyone, but it's just not true. You're already behaving in a certain way before you know it.
You're making judgments about people. You don't actually know anything about them, just on appearances. The signals you're getting from other people about who that person is.
At the beginning we were talking about the unspoken, you know, and that which is still in language. That's all in language, all of that stuff, where you're already set up in your slightly submissive position to the head of school, because the head of school determines whether you're hired or not. Do you know how you can't ignore the fact that if you piss the head of school off, you know, it's going to have consequences. You know all that. You haven't thought it. You've just gone in there and you're just not rude to him. You know, or her. You know how we. It's amazing, the whole. Anyway, but I'm just putting out.
You feel terrible because you feel like a creep.
I've recorded myself. This was one of a great piece of self knowledge, with Dave Chalmers, who's a famous philosopher in Australia. Well, he's in New York now, I think. And I thought I was having a talk between equals, and then I listened to the recording, and I was this such an obsequious I was cringing at myself.
I shouldn't.
I really thought I was holding my own, you know. And I thought if I didn't know who he was, I wouldn't have treated him like that. It's the fame, you know.
I think when I was reading the chapter by Maturana, it rang true for me, because if you look to the way that you feel, I think for most people who've had some kind of reasonably normal development, actually feeling in an environment of cooperation and mutual trust actually feels a hell of a whole lot better than being in a situation of domination and submission. I mean, situations where people are power playing all the time are a pain in the blooming neck. They're horrible. They don't feel you kind of feel it in your body and in your whole being that you want to get out of there.
Yes.
Well, I certainly do.
Yes.
And when I come to FAB or I go to a MIACRA class or something like that, and I'm with a group of people that are mutually cooperating, it actually feels nice. I relax. I become more less guarded. I become more fit, and when I think about the survival of the fittest, I don't necessarily think of somebody being physically fit, I think of somebody being emotionally fit as well. And I think being emotionally fit for us humans means being in that kind of environment.
Well,
you
And Maturana's going to agree with you there.
Yeah.
But I'd like you to... I mean, the main thing I want... I mean this lecture as a kind of a gift. I'm just saying, here's a different myth. I think it's in a way, our understanding of our origins is always going to be a myth. You can't actually go back there. But there's something about... neither is a myth a pure fiction. It can resonate in you, like you were saying. You know, you can say, oh, no, I do, I recognise something in this myth that resonates in how I am. It's not like a scientific theory where it's proven. But if there's resonance, then there's a level there where it's better to have a myth that doesn't, I mean, first, flatly contradict the facts, right? That's where the myth becomes questionable, when you know that you're kind of you're deceiving yourself. You're wanting to believe something to make yourself feel good. There's another level of myth where you say, no, this corresponds with how it is in me, and it's a more accurate correspondence of the facts with how I understand it is what it is to be a human being. I'm giving you Maturana as for me, in that domain of science, it's the best explanation that I've come across that starts to make evolution into something that isn't this dreadful story of slaughter. Although there's elements of that in it. Yes. But it's kind of trying to answer the question, and the philosophy of language is doing that. What does it mean to be human? That's the kind of question we're asking. So the basic story is that it's the mother-child relationship in the mammals and then in the human beings. We're going to talk about the fathers, you know, in a little while, but it's essentially the connection through actually giving birth that is the foundation of, we're going to say, what is love. It's the foundation of love on Earth, if you like. And it only really emerges with the evolution of the mammals. Now, there's a deeper question there. Is the love in the universe? It's a bit like, is the consciousness in the universe? It's your supernature question. Was love there already? Which we're not answering today, right? We're certainly saying that it seems to be with the mammals that the space, a certain space of love opens up with the need to nurture the young through a long period, not just a few days, you know, not just through the season and then off you know the birds. This is why you can eat the birds. No, I'm just, you know, but no, sorry.
No, but the penguins, for example,
yeah,
they
do a lot. Yeah, I don't eat penguins.
I'm sure they delight with the little young one when they finally hatch up and they can get out.
Down there in the South Pole, they do a lot for those little chicks, don't they? Shuffling around. We won't go there, but it's essentially we're saying at a certain point in evolution the mammals arose, you know, and if you wanted to see there was some intelligence behind it, you can sort of see in the dinosaurs there was a different ethic going on Earth. It was the ethic of sheer muscle and weight and power and force.
There was little ones.
Yeah, there was some.
Yeah, okay, all right. Yeah, I know. I've lived in Australia. I know about the lizards and the snakes. Yeah. But even the lizards, they're... Anyway, one's not petting them. Let's put it that way.
Yeah. Now it's the dinosaur is more intellectual. Like today, like it's the intellect. Like before, you needed claws and fangs and very heavy and ferocious and your big mouth.
Yeah, yeah.
But now it's the intellect.
Well, so
the mammals,
was some kind of catastrophe, apparently, wasn't there? The ecological catastrophe that enabled the mammals to fill a niche, and that was our origin, really. We now taken over from the dinosaurs. It's the day of the mammals. Maybe there'll be another day of the who knows what's.
Well, yeah, it's really cool, that niche filling, isn't it? Like in New Zealand, where you get
all brontosaurus have another brain. It's
the birds filling different niches. It's so big, and you get like ones that are like rodents, and they just fill that niche.
Yes.
The space makes
well protected. Yeah.
Yes.
Fill that space, even though they're completely different.
Yes.
They're a bird.
Yes. And we're doing that, having lived in Australia, of course, we're mucking all that up. But it'll settle down, you know. All the dogs and cats and everything will kind of come to some equilibrium if it was allowed. But back to the lineages. This picture of childhood, I need to emphasise this, is. It's actual bodily contact is the fundament of it as well. It's not, you're not Skyping your baby, right? But it's no good Skyping a baby. You have to hold a baby. The entire mammalian thing is a physical. It's really simple, right? I was going to talk about love and what loving behaviour means. It means that you can. That somebody's not going to bite you, somebody's not going to tear you with their fingernails, right? That you can just kind of, and you can push someone, and it's understood that was fun. Do you know there's a whole, the actual dynamic that puppies know as well, right? You know, if you've had a dog understands it. You know,
yeah,
it's a game. You know, he's biting your hand,
yeah.
He doesn't really bite you.
Yeah,
and there's a whole, you know. It's a physical to begin with, absolutely sense of physical intimacy.
Playful.
Yeah, where you don't hurt each other. You know, because we're up in our psyches, right? And our psyches are kind of extensions of that, where we hurt each other or we're playful with each other, but it comes out of the body. The body's the fundament where it begins, and that's where the child and the mother develop or don't. You know, I'm not saying it's, but that's where that fundamental trust and nearness, you know, becomes manifest on Earth. Right, we're just looking at the manifestation of it, and of course the chimpanzees have that too. Right, all of the mammals have that too. But Maturana's point is that we didn't stop. Our capacity for nearness and intimacy continued into adult life. Why did it do that? Let's tell the story. So there's a couple of slides on corporation intelligence because. It's introduced in the reading in two places, so we'll just go on with this first. It will be repeated later. So we're looking at cooperation, essentially what cooperation is, and the word is consensual, which means it's whether you join in or not is purely a matter of, and I bring us back to our room here. It's a matter of invitation. Right? There's no demand. A demand always has a certain reward, right, or punishment behind it. For cooperation, in its essence, is the absence of that. If you like, the reward is the enjoying of the thing itself. Again, if you're a biologist, you'll say something like endorphins. You know, you're getting a payoff. But essentially, if we look at it at a human level, you're not getting any kind of future payoff. You're just here because it's enjoyable to be here. You're not even going to get. I mean, you might get a certificate, but it's not really. That's why I love FUB, right?
Yeah.
It takes that whole aspect of. I'm just here for the assignment. I mean, A lot of education now is like that. It's, why are you telling me that? Is it on the assignment? You know, what do I need to know that for? Bloody philosophy. I'm sorry, I'm...
There is a future payoff. It's good for your health.
Yes, but in a sense, you're not doing it for as some kind of investment,
yeah.
Really. I mean, even if there is something, even if there wasn't a future payoff, I'm here just because I like doing this.
Yeah. But it's for me, future payoff is I'm doing something that makes me feel good. And
yeah.
I know that doing things that make me feel good are making me a healthier, happier person.
Yeah, yeah.
It's immediate payoff.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it's also
yeah.
Well, this sucks, but it'll do me good.
Yeah.
No. But I think we do a lot of things that make us feel good because
yeah.
We know that it extends our happy, healthy life.
Mm-hmm.
I hope. I'm guessing, but
so there's a simple point Maturana wants to make here, which is that essentially when you're in a cooperative state like this, there's a certain space, almost a play space. It's the extension of, you know, children and puppies, and they play, right? They just play. They just try stuff out and see what happens. And in a way, it's part of the necessity to do that, so that they learn the survival skills later. But in playing for the fun of it, you do find stuff out. You stumble across things that you didn't expect to find out. Because you've opened up a certain unregulated space where you're just following some other dynamic, a dynamic of what you find enjoyable. What he wants to say is that that's completely different to the kind of space that opens up if you're in competition. Now, and that's not to say that the space that opens up in competition is completely closed, because generally you've got something in the competition that you want to achieve, and you're applying what you would call your intelligence to whatever that is, making money, getting a meal on the table, da 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 da. All the point he's making here is that if the essential mood is one of competition, then there's a narrowing down. It's almost computational. There's a narrowing down of the possible behaviours that you'll explore. And if you're in a state of cooperation, there's just an opening out of that and a greater chance of your discovering some new way of behaving. He's a systems biologist, and ways of behaving are extremely significant to him, because once you discover a new way of behaving that you enjoy, that's all well and good if you're just playing. But the important next step is that you conserve it, that it becomes part of your way of life, because then it becomes something that you pass on. So he's looking at the space of cooperation, the space of play is a place where you can discover new kinds of behaviours, and if you discover a particular kind of behaviour that is enjoyable, and it could also be that it's a very effective way of catching rabbits,
mm-hmm.
for example. You know, it doesn't mean that it's going to have no practical consequence whatsoever. The next step then is that you discover behaviours that are worth conserving, and conserving is what's important here, because it's only what's conserved, what's repeated, that gets handed down through the generations, and this is the beginning of the systems. Understanding of evolution. Evolution is the evolution of behaviours, not of genetic material. It's the evolution of what he's going to call manners of living. That it's actually the manners of living that define a particular species, not the DNA. There's more to come on that. First thing on language, then. Well, I can cut to the quick. What was the thing we discovered by playing together?
Language.
So, I'll read this out. different people have different ideas about dogs and what their capacities are. I didn't want to go into, you know, because there have been various experiments where primates have been taught sign language, and we're definitely getting to an intermediary state where it's not clear if they have language or not. I'd like to leave that grey area. I think it's less grey with a dog. Dogs do not live in language among themselves or with us, but when we live with them in some stable nearness and intimacy and in the proper flow of recurrent interactions. Now, recurrent interactions is a special systems term, right? Things have got to be recurrent, as in repeat, in the same form, in order for them to become... it's almost like a behaviour is almost like a thing, like an entity that exists in its own right. Because a behaviour has a certain form. You know, we tend to think the only things that have forms are cups, tables, chairs and bodies. But I guess it's time I digressed back to autopoiesis, which is Maturana's most famous discovery. Autopoiesis is the form of life. And the form of life is not a living cell, for instance. It's the form of the process that the cell enacts. That's quite a precise... It's the form of the process that the cell enacts. And what a living cell does, it's the process that it enacts is a continual reconstitution of itself. It's a self-creation. So the material in a cell, all of it except the DNA, is continuously being replenished. So it's taking material in from the outside through the membrane, and it's reconstituting the proteins that make up the metabolic processes that go on in the cell. They break down, they're thrown out, new material comes in, the membrane itself is continuously reconstituting itself, all of the proteins, all of the RNA inside the cell is reconstituting itself. Only the DNA, which is a kind of a pattern, it's just a kind of a pattern for stamping out proteins, really. But the life of the cell is the process that it's going through. And the cell is alive for as long as that process is continuing. So what is the cell? The cell is the form of that process. It's not the stuff, the atoms and molecules, that make it up, because they coming and going, coming and going.
It's like a song.
Yeah. A song's a good example of it. Now, it's a small step now, I think, for you to see that... a certain way that we have of behaving is a process like that. And we don't recognise the being of processes because of our culture. Our culture is utterly fixated on the material, on the matter. And we think our bodies are made of matter, but our bodies are all made of cells, and the material that our bodies are made of is in a continuous flow. And that what you take to be your body is the form of that flow. Do you get a feeling for this? Because if you do, you start, in a way, you know, you start to think, oh God, you know, why were we thinking otherwise? Do you know? And you can start to sort of think, oh yeah, no, the teeth, they don't flow as much. Yeah, you know, there are bits, the bones, they do flow, the bones, but they flow really slowly. And the whole, I mean, there's amazing stuff, right? The whole body, including the DNA, is reproducing itself. Fascinating thing is that the neurons don't. So there's something special about the brain. If you start looking at the form of the body, I mean, there are stem cells that can become neurons, but very few, you get very few new neurons in your life. Most of the neurons that are in your brain now were there when you were a child. But all of the other cells in your body have all died, disappeared and come back, except the eggs. The eggs are another super special cell. All this is, if you look at biology with fresh eyes, all this is terribly meaningful.
But it's all contained in the first cell of you as well, the first time you split all those diversify from.
It's all in the cell. You know, it goes back 3.5 billion years. You know, we're still.
Yeah, we're all related. We're all the same thing.
It's one. It's the all of life on Earth. Once you start to see this, is one enormous form.
So the DNA in the cell that doesn't change.
The DNA in the cells that reproduce.
Once it's reproduced.
Yes.
So the DNA
is the only thing that remains static.
So it doesn't break down all the.
No. I mean, it can get damaged, but in a healthy cell, the DNA, you know, when a cell reproduces, it actually assembles another piece of DNA for the second cell, and then they split. Yes, and so the original DNA in one cell is still the original DNA, but the new cell is just being made.
Yeah.
So it's all a process of copying.
Yeah.
The virus wants to get into the DNA so that it copies itself.
But what about epigenetics?
Well, the epigenetics is in relation to what we're talking about here is to do with how evolution occurs outside of the changing of the DNA. But epigenetics is also a big area now because they've started to realise that, we've got the same DNA in all of our cells, and our cells are utterly different, right? All over the body, they're all different. They're different because certain genes are expressed and certain genes are not expressed within each cell, and that makes it the cell that it is. But for a long time, people thought, oh, yeah, but once it's a brain cell, it's a brain cell. Once it's a liver cell, it's a liver cell. But it turns out that during the lifetime of the body, individual cells, you can change the gene expression according to the environment. So the environment can actually switch genes on and off as well. And particularly, you know, they study what's the effects of stress can change the way the DNA is expressed. So the DNA isn't fixed, right? That's epigenetics is about, well, the way the entire system is functioning affects the way the DNA operates. And so the whole idea, the original idea that the DNA is like a line of program code that says this is what the cell's going to do, it's not fixed. The cell, remember the word, it's the crucial word here, and he doesn't mention it, is feedback. Right? The cell feeds back on the DNA, and the cell affects how the DNA expresses itself. And then the DNA, the way the DNA expresses itself, affects the way the cell develops. So as soon as you've got feedback, you've got a complex system. But epigenetics goes beyond that towards how our conservation of certain forms of behaviour also affects our survival. So you see the mode of behaviour that a species has is really what determines whether it's going to survive or not. Its DNA is involved, but the way that a species survives is a matter of how the previous generation were behaving. Yeah, the DNA doesn't specify the behaviour of a species. To an extent it does. It specifies the domain of possible behaviours that a species could have. But the actual behaviour that a species has is determined by how they were behaving already, right? By the world you're born into, and it's the way you actually behave that determines who's going to survive and who isn't, or let's put it this way: who's going to reproduce and who isn't. Do you see? It's not the. You look at how we are. And how our cultures are, and how we've survived. It's no longer been about tigers eating us. Right? But Maturana is saying, but that, we're not unique in that, right? All of the species find their niches and find modes of behaviour. And if a species dies out, it's because its mode of behaviour didn't fit with the way that the niche changed, not that its DNA didn't fit. It may have been conceivably possible for that species to have accidentally stumbled across another way of behaving that would have enabled it to survive with the same DNA. Do you see? He's trying to break this link, this idea that the DNA is determining everything.
Yes. Because
yes.
So.
And they discover.
Yeah,
they discover so yeah. One animal. I mean, one animal discovers that behaviour, and then another copies, and it becomes embedded, and it becomes a form now of the polar bear's behaviour. Yes.
So it's not evolution then; it's modification.
Well, if you, it's called structural drift. We'll come to that. It's evolution's there too, right? Because in that sense, it depends what you mean by evolution.
We're not evolving, we're modifying according to different.
But you could have said that about ordinary evolution theory too, couldn't you?
So it's wrong to think of it as evolution. It's right to think of it as we are modifying our behavior. Our behavior is
being, our behavior is being modified, but then so is our DNA.
I think there's a question of, like, if a newborn has a particular color and that color is then making him more, camouflaged in the environment.
Yes.
That has nothing to do with behavior,
yeah.
And that's kind of pure evolution.
Yeah.
Because nothing has been modified by learning, by new effort or whatever. It just happened that he is more camouflaged, and therefore he will have an advantage in the big evolution game. So that is like pure evolution. Nothing conscious, nothing learning, nothing. Just.
So just to clarify that.
Simplicity.
We're looking at the neocortex in a way, because once you need a certain level of sophistication of possible behaviours, which the neocortex, that top layer of the brain, starts to represent. It's the mammals that start to have the capacity to develop more and more sophisticated behaviours, and there are many species like the insects that have to rely on more traditional forms, if you like, of our idea of evolution, where you just have to bump into an accident, a form of fortuitous genetic randomness. Yes, but at the same time, from a systems biology point of view, that species is a behaviour. It's a certain behaviour that then. It's the behaviour of the species that determines the genetic material that will survive. It's because of the behaviour of the insect that it's colonised a certain kind of tree, let's say. I'm making this up, right? That the genetic variations that camouflage it to that tree survive. But that particular species could have had a different form of behaviour which didn't involve that tree. Do you know?
Yeah.
There's a feedback.
So like chameleons have learned to move slowly and therefore the ones that will survive.
Well, learn's the wrong. Is it, in a way, it's the wrong word.
Yeah.
Because in a way, it's the ones who didn't do that got eaten.
Yeah.
You know, it's brutal learning. Once you've got a brain like us, our learning is in our prediction. We project our possible demise, whereas other species, they can't project their possible demise. They actually have to die to discover that doesn't work. Do you know, we that's what our brains give us.
So they go back to the birds that you might eat because they only live in the present, from what you were saying earlier.
Well, now, since I've done a bit more reading, you know, there's another layer on the on the you know, the reptilian brain, the bird's brain actually has evolved from the reptilian brain, and they've got something a bit neocortical like, and the crows are very clever.
Yeah,
probably shouldn't be eating the birds either. Yeah, yeah, the minor birds in Australia, they were pretty smart. Yeah, the seagulls.
They distract you and then they feed you.
Come on, John. So I didn't get through to we got to the stable nearness and intimacy with our dogs and the recurrent interactions. That's where I got stuck, about the recurrent interactions are the birth of forms. You know, and if the recurrent interactions go deep enough, then they'll be passed on to the next generation and they become forms of life. You know, like the cell is a form of life, a behaviour can be a form of life, but at a higher level. Because you've got the form of life of the cell, and then the form of life of the cells together forming your body, and then you've got the form of life of the behaviour of the body. I'm just trying to give you a sense of systems thinking that said all these are just different levels of being. There isn't just this atoms and molecules level, because if you look into what an atom and a molecule is, an atom is a form of being, right? And nobody really knows what the electrons are, right? There's a kind of a model of electron shells, but that's a sheer form, right? Electrons only appear when you try and measure them. What they are when you're not trying to measure them. I mean, how are you going to know? You've got to bounce something off to see that there's an electron there. I won't go into the physics, but you know the gist of it. And then you get down to the neutrons and the protons. When I was a boy, I thought, oh yeah, they're like little marbles. No. There's processes that form them. You know, it's turtles all the way down. You know, it's processing, till finally you get to the quantum level, and you know, there's a superposition of possible states there. There's no stuff. I mean, this is modern science. If you just absorb modern science fully, it should just start to make you feel, oh.
This is like movement.
Yes.
Patterns.
Yeah. It's a dance of form. It's just that we get, especially human intelligence, we get very fixed on certain forms, on the absolute existence of certain forms. There's something that almost we have to work against that in our intelligence if we're doing philosophy, because we have to observe it.
That's why the church, as we were saying before, couldn't survive, because it thought it was complete and finished and pinned down.
Yes.
So
yes.
Dead already, you know, couldn't.
Yes, there's a certain recognition in Maturana, and I think we have to share it too, that this idea that we could in any sense, and I think was it Marina? Yes, Marina was saying, you know, there's no possibility of ever understanding everything all at once.
Which is great.
You know, because to understand everything all at once, in some sense, you have to be outside of it, looking at it. So it's not everything, because there you are, outside of it, looking at it. You see, it just can't be done. But we can certainly, that doesn't mean that we don't see aspects of it. It doesn't mean we fall into a relativity where you say we can't know anything. Anyway, but that's a digression. So with our dogs, they participate in a more or less extended episodic manner. In a sense, it means that the behaviours that they engage in with us that have a languaging dimension to it, because you know if you with a dog, I mean it's saying throw it,
yeah.
You know, I've dropped the ball, now throw it. There's a whole, you know, there's a whole thing going on with you and your dog. The episodic manner is that they're dependent on us for that. They're fitting in behaviourally with our behavioural structure, but we are the if you like, we're the source of that, and the animals are able to engage with us in an episodic way, which means that only occasionally, according to us being there. And if we left them to their own devices, they wouldn't start behaving like humans in the way that they do when they live with us.
But you start behaving like them too when you're a kid. You know, the dog's lying on the floor, you lie on the floor too.
Oh, yes.
I related more to our dogs.
I'm starting to observe that they learn how to evoke behaviour in us.
He's driving a cat.
Oh, yeah.
They're so direct, because then they don't have all these stupid ideas. They just know that this works, and we think, you cunning thing, you know, as if they've thought it all out. No, this works, you know. This little kind of soppy dog look, you know, and I hold my paw up. Yeah, it works. I didn't sit, you know, one night thinking, how shall I fool them? No, it's not like that. So, for that to happen between any pair of animals, certain emotioning, which means, again, he's very behavioristic in this way. Everything has to be a behaviour within his biological understanding. Emotioning is a configuration of relational dynamics. So, for him to be aggressive is a certain form of behaviour. And to be loving is a certain form of behaviour. But at the same time, I think he recognises, and we all sort of recognise what you're saying, Maria, when you engage in that form of behaviour, you have it feels like something. There's a phenomenological dimension of the feeling of what it's like to behave that way. And there's a physiological dimension, right, and all the chemicals that are released, etc., etc. So it's not saying that... he's not saying exactly what love is from the inside. He's saying it's a certain mode of behaviour on the outside, but it involves... It's not fake either. It's not fake love. In order to be in trust, you have to be in trust. That means you're not calculating what you're doing in order to manipulate somebody else. That's a definite state. And when you're not in a state of calculating what you're doing in order to manipulate somebody else, then you're in a state of trust. And a state of trust is a state of love. You know, I was talking about, so what's love? I mean, for many people who are in a loving relationship, from my observation, there is a certain calculation going on. There can be. So that somebody's simulating love. It's quite possible to simulate love. And one of the reasons that we have such a difficulty with the word is because we dissimulate, we human beings. Especially in our... You know, I don't know if I wanted to open this up, but, you know, in our sexual relationships, particularly, I mean, speaking as a man, when a man's, you know... thinks that loving behaviour is going to elicit some sexual satisfaction, you know. The man will dissimulate, you know. Oh, yes, yes, no, I love you, I love you. Yeah, yeah, I love you. I love you, but, you know. Yeah, I love you. Yes, yes. I'm not saying it's entirely...
It's not just guys.
I'm not saying it is, but I'm inclined to say that maybe that form of behaviour was initiated by the male.
Well, I don't know. If you want to get a guy into bed, just massage his ego.
Yes.
It works.
Yes.
Most of the time.
So
it was just in a moment there, John.
Yes.
Thought, well, we are in love here, and we've formed. We've got a behaviour. We've got a form going on here.
Yep.
In that moment, I got to something. Else.
Yes. That's the idea.
In that moment.
Yeah.
A few minutes ago.
Yes. Yes, odd things can happen, you know, because we, you know, there can be moments of love and you don't even notice. Because we think we've got this whole thing that love's got, you know, it's spangly, you know, it's amazing. There's a great kind of burst of consciousness associated with love, and sometimes you know, a loving action occurs, and somebody it just occurs. And I don't know if you sometimes you'll realize afterwards. Yeah, yeah, it's getting quite warm, isn't it? Well, you could turn the heater down. Yeah. Do you know you can be in a state of loving harmony with someone just on a walk together, and you're just talking about whatever you're talking about, and you're just walking, right? And I mean, this often happens if somebody dies, you suddenly realize. It's hard to start a lecture again. I still, even so, I want to get through the lecture. But I think you know that moment, right, where a lot of your life, your loving life, you might not even recognize it as it's occurring. But yeah, that you pointed that out, because even in a not even, but in a group like this together, just in our very listening to each other, you know, there's, you stop calculating, you just hear, you know, this is what Maturana is talking about us being loving beings, you know, even though we can snap, right? We can snap into another state, and it's not that everyone's in a loving state. Somebody else might be thinking, oh my God, you know, how long is this going to, you know, it's a very subtle state, and yet it's one of the things that he's saying is it's a completely natural background state for us. It's not something we have to work at. In a way, we have to work at leaving it. And one of the ways that we work at leaving it is by, behaving badly to each other. I mean, there's an enormous area we can't go into here about why human beings aren't loving to each other, and there are a lot of reasons for that. And we can't go into that here, even though they're extremely important for us, really, you know, significant.
I think one of the things that has changed in kind of general understanding about love is the importance of love in childhood. Because I remember in the 50s that there was a lot of stuff about if a baby cries, you have to leave it in the pram and ignore it. You know, you don't indulge children. You know, and this has really, really changed, I think, in common understanding that experiences in babyhood and early childhood really affects the individual, and that they do need unconditional love. That's been a real shift, I think, in consciousness about these things, because I've witnessed the change in that, you know, the change of kind of ethos about how you treat children. I mean, when I was a child, it was acceptable to beat children and to stick them in a corner if they did something wrong, or to ignore them if they cried, you know. And that's really changed.
To blame them for your
own. Blame them for things. I think that's really changed. Not for everybody, I have to say.
But there has been a radical shift.
But there's been a kind of an acknowledgement.
Absolutely.
Was there something that accompanied that? Because, I was a child in the 60s, I was born then. And I know my parents, I think was it the Spock book?
Yes.
I don't know if there was
Dr.
a...
Spock.
Yeah, yeah, Dr. Spock.
Well, that was
Spock
one,
Child.
Yeah, there's Duncan,
yeah.
Dr. Spock.
Yeah,
Child.
I remember the book.
Yeah.
that was a big shift, actually.
Yeah.
Because he, And also, I think, who was it who wrote Childcare?
Bowlby.
Bowlby, that's
yeah,
it. Bowlby.
He was cool, Bowlby. He wasn't harsh. He was the one who was saying, you need a...
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. That's what effected the change.
Yeah. Oh, I see.
Obviously, Bowlby has had a lot of feminist criticism. But at the time, it made a shift between seeing the child as essentially an unfeeling, non-remembering thing, that you could, as long as you didn't bounce them off the walls, they were basically okay. You just had to feed them and, you know, this kind of stuff. But you, kind of, they...
Original sin.
They didn't remember trauma.
Yeah.
To a difference in attitude that actually... That close, loving relationship was important to children, and if they didn't get it, it could cause damage.
And that comes through all the psychology books now, doesn't it?
It's generally accepted.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And in supporting young people and the whole mental health, which wouldn't have existed in the '50s and sixties, CANs and all that.
So I've got to try and give the punchline of this slide, right? The punchline of this slide, and of almost the whole book, is that how did something as extraordinary as languaging behaviour, how could it possibly have emerged?
Did you bring the book, John?
Yes. I don't know where I've got my book.
Nicola likes me to have the book on the table.
If you haven't seen it, there it is.
Yeah.
The whole argument of the book is that in order for language, which is an incredibly sophisticated behaviour, to have emerged and been conserved, there had to have been this openness of possible behaviours that's only... accessible when you're in a playful cooperation together. It has to be extended over a long period of time in order for it to become habitual. Yes, do you see? We're not going into the details of how it happened. We're saying, but there had to be an environment, something like this, in order for it to have occurred. As a form of demonstrative proof, he's saying, look at the chimpanzees. They didn't develop such a form of behaviour. Right? They're an example of something that was very, basically the same brute as us originally, who carried on behaving in an entirely competitive manner. And they evolved like this. Yes? And we're an example. We evolved differently. Now, if we forget about the DNA and we look at evolution as an evolution of behaviours, I mean, Maturana's understanding is that our bodies evolve according to our behaviour. Right? It's the behaviour that drives the evolution of the body. I mean, I'm going to jump ahead a slide or two here. Basically, he's saying that once you've got a certain mode of behaviour, then... that creates a kind of he calls it a canal. Right? Everybody in the species is living in that canal, behaving in that way. And any kind of genetic changes that fit with that mode of behaviour will survive, right? And any that don't, won't. And that doesn't mean you just die. It means you were a very poor communicator and nobody wanted to make babies with you, basically. That would be one way of looking at it, right? Your whole languaging thing didn't really take off. you can see people who start to language and start to enjoy languaging are going to join together with other people who are good at languaging and enjoy languaging together. And after a while, one thing leads to another, babies emerge. Do you see there's a whole other dynamic, especially in a more sophisticated species, where the behaviour is going to start to determine who mates with whom and who survives. And not only that, if you are unable to follow the languaging that is determining
the agreements, because languaging becomes an agreement about how to behave together. You see, it becomes a mode of behaviour of another level, where you can start to coordinate how you act together at an incredible fineness of detail. Do you know, you can't explain to your dog, can you, that I'll see you at 5 o'clock? I mean, you can if you're always coming in at five, but just especially today, I'd like you to... Do you see what language does in terms of our ability to coordinate what we do? So anyone in that canal, if you like, of evolution that wasn't able to coordinate so well through the language doesn't behave so effectively, right? Which means doesn't survive so well. There only has to be a small differential that's going to favour the people who are adapted to language are the ones who are going to survive. And not just that, this is going back 3 million years. So we've got over 3 million years, the individuals who are adapted to language are breeding and reproducing and living together in a certain form. And that slowly is going to select the bodies that are most fitted to that way of life. And here they are, right? And And there we were. You see the jaw, the upright stance, the neck, the larynx. I mean, there's more than that, and I'm hoping to get to it. About, you know, us losing hair. I mean, this. What has that got? What was that about? Well,
clothes maybe.
No, we'll get there in a minute. Honestly.
But also, the thing is, it's like, okay, even if you accept that the language is what differentiated us and then created the also subtle differences in body shape and all of that, that's still not necessarily. So it may have been a random thing that has evolved in one group of our common ancestors, and that one group has then kind of migrated. But because there were already other groups in which language didn't evolve, those then continued and are now the chimpanzees. But I'm
so
not
hold
saying...
So the chimps were quite separate from us before we started to develop language. So it was... It wasn't that there was language and the chimps went off. They were already over there, if you like. But there were various lineages that came off our branch that didn't survive.
Okay. Because this assumption that language is a result of this extension of the mother-child love into adulthood.
Yes.
As the what brings up language. I mean, although it does make sense... because it's
going to
create more loving.
Yeah, and if I could correct assumption to, it's a theory.
Yeah.
It's not being assumed.
But what I'm saying is that also in the domination-submission relationship, there could be a rise for language under those conditions. So
just to reiterate, I'm arguing for Maturana here.
Yeah.
Maturana is saying to you, I can be him now,
yeah.
He's saying, okay, so why didn't the chimps learn to speak? Because they were basically, they started with the same genetic stock as us millions of years ago, and they exhibited throughout that time a fairly static, stable way of living in mistrust and competition in their adult life. What caused them not to develop language and to be reasonably insensitive to our attempts to create it in them, although maybe with some more... I think there might be the possibility that we could start over a long period of time to get the chimpanzees to speak.
Yeah, because I just read recently there was something about the chimpanzees are now going through a stone age of some sort and they are developing some tools and whatever. I don't know if it's kind of how
we have to come back to, you know, crows have tools. It's that whole patriarchal, it's all about the tools, you know. Man is the screwdriver.
Yeah.
He's the hammer, you know.
Yes.
It's the screwdriver and the hammer. It was me. It was me, man, that did it. I've got my little woman here, you know, she came along with me, but it was me and my tools, my spears, you know, I'm evolution, you know, I'm coming back. Do you see, I'm just saying, do you see Maturana's argument is, okay, so if language could have developed in such a scenario, why didn't it with all the other primate species?
How do you know that it didn't?
Well, because it didn't get reproduced. We don't know that it didn't and then died out. But it was only in us that it got conserved.
I'm just a little bit, because when I read something like this, title of this book, as much as, like, you know, we kind of want love and we want to believe that biology is biology of love and all of this, I'm just a little bit kind of like, I want to take it with a pinch of salt. It's not like a postmodernistic kind of way of looking at evolution as, oh yeah, it's all love. Oh,
so
lovely.
So I mean, I feel to defend Maturana in this. He's in the domain of system science. This isn't New Age science, right? This is modern biology, and modern biology is becoming increasingly systems based. So this isn't some kind of crazy divergence away from the mainstream biology. Mainstream biology is starting to accept that we have to understand how systems evolve. It's not all a tale of molecules and DNA. But to take it as far as to say that love is the fundament of our human civilization, that is a big step. My willingness to do that is for me based on my own experience of life, and just biographically, my mum and I, my dad was in the Navy, right? So he was off 3 months at a time. He'd be back for a weekend or two, loads of presents. Just off again, right? It was just me and my mum, and she was a sensitive, loving woman who I was brought up in a total matriarchy, if you like. For me, I feel more than, as I've started to discover in my adult life what other people went through, I realised I had quite an extreme experience of being brought up with the feminine. So what Maturana is saying relates to me very strongly, because I've never, you know, an upbringing like that means that I've never really been able to come to terms with the chimpanzee world.
Well, that's good. I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing.
No, I'm not saying it's a bad thing. No, but you know, I can see my dad. I don't want to cast him but you know, he's going to turn into a poofsteroner. You know, I'm going to be an effeminate homosexual unless I, you know, something's punched into me. You know, there's a whole male kind of thing there that he was exhibiting that just wasn't there in my childhood. I was just this continuous upbringing with the feminine. So that's where I relate back. So there's a resonance here where I feel I experienced this. Do you know, I was reading just because my mum kind of showed me books. I didn't have to learn to read. The whole thing, just all of that stuff. I didn't really need to go to school. I already knew everything I needed to know. Just absorbed it. Just absorbed it off her, you know. I've never had any problem, you know, learning anything. I've never had any sense that I'm kind of damaged, you know, or there's anything wrong with me, or that I couldn't do anything that I wanted to in life. You know, that whole kind of basis that you're supposed to get, I got it. It's only now, you know, in this later part of my life, I sort of see, ah, God, how much it mattered. You know, so there's definitely an arc in me back to this book, where it's not just academic. You know, I can read it in my own life.
Right.
there's information flowing from love,
yeah,
from care, love.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I mean, I'm not going to boast, but I just sort of walked into school, and I can just do exams. You know, what you want me to learn something, I learn something. You know, why has everyone got such a problem with it? Do you know, I couldn't understand all the difficulties everyone was going through.
I had a negative experience of it, of not knowing the stuff, and you know, being made to feel stupid or anything.
Yeah, yeah.
You just learned that you could learn because that's a natural
yeah.
thing to do.
And my sense, and I think it's quite correct, is that if you're good at school, you're intelligent, right? It's not intelligent. I just haven't had all that shit put on me.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, you're missing the stuff that's obscuring everything
yeah.
for everyone else. If that's not there, then. Your brain just kind of works, you know. Your little neurons do what they're supposed to do, and not that it was perfect, but the sense of the difference it made, and the opening up of your intelligence. I lived that, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm.
And I still have it. Do you know the
it's good to recognize it.
Yeah,
and that's obviously clearly what you can do, as you talk about this art.
Yes,
but not everyone gets that. That's
absolutely. That not everyone gets that, but I'm here to bear witness, if you like, that in my life this is true. So it's got a sort of a second dimension to it, you know, which in the area of loving relationships, you know, because that's the other thing where there's been a sort of a breakdown in this world. Is the area of intimate, loving relationships between men and women, you know, and that's also that's the fundament out of which the children are brought up, isn't it?
Can I ask you? I mean, I might read the book; it sounds really interesting. But I mean, in their explanation of why this hasn't persisted, over and above the rise of the agrarian society, I mean, coming into more modern times. Do they mention that the nuclear family is a very fragile environment in which this thing can happen? Because if you've got a family consisting of mum, dad and the kids, or just mum and the kids, there isn't a lot of support for the parent to remain loving and giving.
Yes.
Yeah.
Whereas that's a lot easier when people lived, as we did for thousands of years, in small collective groups, where if one of the parents was ill or whatever, someone else could step in and do the nurturing.
Now, it's not mentioned specifically, but it's mentioned in the background.
Mm.
You know, it's because that whole story is the story, you know, that's playing out now, right?
Mm.
I mean, I feel the speech coming on, because I was there in the 1960s, you know, with the classic nuclear family, one aspect of the classic nuclear family was dad goes out, he earns enough money, your average dad, to buy a house and keep a family. And the whole path of corporate capitalism was how do we keep up demand and pay people less? Send the women out to work. You know, under the guise of liberation.
Mm.
You know, that was just a way of basically halving the wages. You know, now you need two people to pay for the basics. And it's brilliant, you see, because demand had fallen, if you cut wages in half, demand would fall and the economy would collapse. But no, we've got a better idea than that. We'll ride on the back of women's liberation, and we'll halve everyone's wages, not quite half, but pretty much. Do you know the only reason that living standards have been maintained since the 1960s is because of the women going into the workforce.
And I will say something controversial. Now let's have nurseries for 6-week-old babies, which is something that you never saw.
Well, that's the price, right? What's
it's heartbreaking because not everybody wants to, you know, want to leave your children and they're even small if you've got no other option.
Well, this is how you destroy the loving harmony of the of the human species, isn't it?
You make a biddable population that wants to buy shit as well. I guess that's what they've learned.
I mean, the monogamous nuclear family.
Yeah,
yeah. If you look at
we're designed for
every society that's ever lived. I mean, that is a minority option, and it's not very strong. I mean, really, it's not. I mean, the extended family, or I mean, there are tribes where the woman lives with her children and a male relative, and the husband is just like her boyfriend. You know, he's not part of the household.
Oh.
Or you've got well, that's been quite a nice option, I think.
I've got a picture for you.
There's all much better systems than what we've got.
Maria, when I was first in India, you know, and there's a whole thing there. You go to as a Westerner to India, and you think all the arranged marriages, you know, the terrible situation of woman and. You know, what a dreadful way to live, and a horrible poverty, and da-da-da-da-da-da-da, you know, all that kind of Western... if only they were like us. And then when I actually got on the street, and I started to look at some of the children who are on the street, and I picked this picture because it reminded me of the children on the street. I mean, I don't know if that picture expresses it, but there was just such a beauty in the... And their utter poverty. I mean, this girl is obviously... She's not utterly poor, right? But you just bump into... And even the grown-ups, you look and there'd just be such an extraordinary... This state, right? Of loving humanness was just... And it generally gets poorer, and that you'd there'd be almost proportionally, yeah. And this would be, you know, there's no nuclear families there, right? Grandma and grandpa and the aunts and the uncles, everybody's all piled in. You know, they're basically piled in through economic necessity.
Ideally, but there's kids prostituted at railway stations, and there's kids starving and living with dogs. And
yeah, no. Hold it. That I'm not advocating this as a way of life.
Linking it to the poverty, and the poverty is because of greedy people ripping other people.
No, but it wasn't a cause and effect.
There's child prostitution.
Yeah, it wasn't.
I know. Yeah. I'm just saying that because you said as the poorer you get, the more loving families you see.
Yes, but that's to do with the form of life that is being preserved.
Mm-hmm.
That as people get more and more well off,
but not just that.
I mean, this is. I sort of observed this at university. You just need to promote someone ahead of school, and suddenly, the whole dynamics of your relation changes. And if they then get up to dean. The person's become someone else. The poverty. I'm not saying everybody should be in poverty, but it's the utter necessity of it that throws everyone together, and what comes out of it is still this state of being together that when I was in India utterly shocked me. You know, I got back to Bombay, Mumbai airport, and these Germans got off the plane. I'm sorry, there's no Germans here. And it was they were German businessmen, and I just suddenly saw it, you know, what it is to be Western.
Mm-hmm. I saw this the other day. I was at the council and I was doing my role, and I was supporting someone that had to go to occupational health care. You know, there was a lot of family cooperation there. It's time to say this person really isn't well. And, you know, what in the medical framework, what could we do to actually help and support this person? As soon as I came out, it's like it was right by the finance stroke CEO, and you just used the word. Sorry, not the leader of the guy that's in charge of the council, not the leader of the council, but. Right, it's in charge of the council. So you've just gone from one mode of being where it's all kind of loving and quiet, respectful, and then you just see these three suits. And there's something, when you said the word businessman, I just think of a suit. And that, in it, that has, that, that's the, it's not that image, it's something completely different. But that's just in my mind. It's not thought out, it's not rational, but I think it's where we've got to now, where just seeing those images can be quite pejorative.
Yes, I mean, just because you're wearing a suit doesn't have to be behave like that.
No.
But in actual the idea of management is an idea of manipulation and competition. It's chimpanzee world. I don't mean that respectfully either. In the workplace, I've noticed this before. There's often a level where there's a level of cooperation. Nicolette worked as a nurse, right? And especially in education, there's a level at work where you're genuinely colleagues, and then there's another level where that stops. And it's very crisp. You can recognise these different forms of behaviour are still present, absolutely present to us.
And I found that paradoxically, the more you get chimpanzee culture, as you call it, the less you're allowed to be aggressive and express your opposition to things or get cross about things. I mean, when I started working in...
Because you're in submission.
Yeah. When we started working in further education, we all had meetings where we all shouted at each other and, you know, discussed things, debated things, sometimes quite sort of vehemently. And then there was a big change in management and the new manager came in and said, there will be no discussion, there will be no questions. And if any of us said, well, you know, I don't agree with what you've just said, be quiet.
That's
so you are not allowed to express any dissent. And I think that, you know, because we're human beings, that expressing dissent and getting vehement about things and having a bit of a tirade about something that's annoyed you is natural. And it shouldn't mean that you're labelled as, you know, I was labelled as unmanageable and managed out of my job.
Yeah, yeah.
Even though I was getting... You know, I'm not bragging, but I was getting very good results. But I was labelled as unfit to teach and unmanageable. And they got me out. And they got me out by making me out.
Yeah, yeah. And you could see, that's evolution of the other side. Because I actually recognise this because the university system is my kind of area of experience. This corporatisation of the world is just moving ahead. Like a tide, and anyone who is actually fundamentally committed to, in a sense, to a cooperative and loving way of being at work, it's like evolution. You weren't killed, you just didn't fit in that mode of being anymore, and you leave yourself, right? Because it's such hell.
I think that people who perform, who play this game of domination and submission, you know, when they do it, they're not aware of it, they just like reacting subconsciously to it. Once they get educated about it, they pick up the way.
Yeah, but I guess there's a necessity to it in the structure of the organisation. You can't become a head of school, really, and head of school was the interim place where you could just have been a radical head of school and caused a whole lot of trouble. Any higher up, you just don't get there unless you're committed to that form of behaviour. And if you aren't, if you start behaving differently, then you're just got, you know, reassigned.
Yeah. Sometimes it gets very subtle. Like I was in an office and this guy comes in. How are you? All right? You're all right? But you can't do that to him. You can ask you how you're feeling, yeah? So this is, I would prefer this like imposing power to like manipulate,
yeah.
You know, pretending as if you have the power but you don't actually have it. So I would prefer, so it's like, so I tried once to do it. Hi, you're right? And he was like... He was like, how could you not I do this? I asked.
I got this the other day. I got this with a layer of management, because it's the way that the office can be, they corporatize it to the extent that, you know, rather than have individual offices where people can be, there's an open planned office supposedly to see more cooperation and everything else. But and the flattening of the structures. So I was just speaking to what next to me, what I consider to be colleagues, but there is a little hierarchy in terms of my manager is just opposite. Yeah? And then there was another manager that came over, and then the topic of the conversation was about the council's big on apprenticeships at the moment, and they've got a fund, £2 million that they can use for apprenticeships. You know? We're not, as trade unions, fundamentally opposed to that either, but in a meeting where all of this was spoken through. And but this manager came over and made a big thing and said, apprenticeships, can we get them? And I happened just to say myself, I said, well, yeah, of course you can get them. And in fact, even redeployees can become apprenticeships. But it came from me. It didn't come from the manager that was opposite, where he, I don't know if his total line of direction was, but it's because it came from me, total shock. Wasn't pleased with what I was saying in that redeployees could have these options as well, and totally backed off, sidetracked me, only looked, and then, as if total disdain, who are you? You're pretty low in the structure to even know about this, you know? But that really stayed with me for a couple of days, in that how that pecking order in a hierarchy, how those people want to make you feel because they think that they are above you. And that bit I don't agree to, but, you know, then it's almost my own thing that I'm left with. You know what I mean? It's my own, perhaps it's my own chip on my own.
It's like not being seen, isn't it? It feels like people are aliens when they treat you like that,
what I'd like to emphasise here is these are modes of behaviour, right? Because what we tend to do is we tend to say, well, I'm not like that. I'm a loving, cooperative human being, and you're one of those chimps, right? But in fact, we're all human beings who can engage in different modes of behaviour, and it's a matter of what we choose to do.
Yeah.
It's you aren't just because you're the dean. If I were the dean, I'd have to have been like that, right? I would, and you know, and I know Clyde, a friend of mine. He was a decent man who suffered. You could see he's really internally. He suffered, but he had to do it. And different people tell them, and that people do things like say, "Well, somebody had to do it. It's better that it was me than that other really cruel person." Do you know there are people in a way, in certain sense, nobly take on the role, even though they know that they're going to have to start behaving.
Better headmasters and worse ones.
Yes. Yeah, no, because you can still bring integrity to the role, or you can bring dishonesty. You can still be a good dean or a bad dean, or whatever it is, a good manager or a bad manager. I hesitate in this, you know, when you label somebody.
It was a
snippet there. Yeah, in these structures that we build in the world, once you place someone in the position, in the structure, like me being a lecturer, I just happen to like it, right? So it suits me. But that's not, that's, it's just a mode of behaviour. And we can take them all on. There's no, I'm a bit uncomfortable with the moral finger, you know, because you've got to be living in Nazi Germany before you really know where you stand. Do you know, it's easy for us to be kind of to live like we are living because we've got the kind of economic freedom to do it.
But Adorno says that, I mean, it is the lack of the very thing that Maturana's talking about, which was the central aspect of the kind of child-rearing practices that existed in Germany when Hitler was growing up. That allowed the Holocaust to happen, because you had all these authoritarian personalities that worshipped power and authority and killed anything soft and loving in themselves, because that's how they've been conditioned, by and large. And I mean, you look at the way Hitler was being brought up, and you suddenly you understand where he was coming from.
Yes.
His father was a complete and absolute sadist. But not only that, Hitler was not allowed to hate his father, because when his father had hung him upside down in a tree and beaten him until he bled, he had to get down off the tree and kiss his father's feet and say thank you. Yes, yes, and his mother made him do it. So he had no allies. Now, I mean, you think about the damage that that child went through, and he grew up into, you know, the Adolf we know and love.
He didn't, it wasn't only him who engineered the whole thing.
No, I know, but if you look at that kind of template for childhood upbringing, you know, this is what they call the rise of the authoritarian personality, which is just chimpanzee behaviour par excellence.
So I've got, because
you know,
we ought to have left already, and there's one thing there's one very important aspect. I'm even going to skip this.
We're not going to do the slides.
We are, but before we go, I want to talk about how Maturana, because what he sees happened, because we were talking about how we look, how we are. It's a well-recognized biological feature called neoteny, which is where actual physical childhood features and behaviours are prolonged into adulthood. So the reason we look like we do and the chimps look like they do is because we still look like babies, basically. We're still babies or young children. We didn't grow into the chimp adulthood, right? What he's proposing is that we started to extend childhood into adulthood, and we actually, that meant extending behaviours, but also the physical features of being children into adulthood. And I want to give you, before we finish, what he considers to be the fundamental driver of that was sexuality. Was that... That the men and the women, and this may well have preceded languaging, started to play around physically as well, enjoying intimacy and sexual contact, and at a certain point, the kind of annual being on heat of the females started to expand, and he's talking about the evolution of behaviour here. How did it come to be that unlike other primates, except the bonobos, human females, women, are what's the word?
Available.
Short is all.
Yeah, potentially available. It's no longer biologically set that this is the mating season because it's a good time of year, you know, to rear children. If 10 months later it's a good time of year because there's crops or whatever, it's a good time to feed the children. It starts to expand and expand to fill the entire year. Why is that? And he's saying, well, the reason is that that sort of behaviour, he's saying that the evolution is behaviour driven. So the behaviour will have been that the enjoyment of sexual contact came first, and that started to expand the enjoyment of being close, physically close, between the man and the woman, which is essentially the enjoyment that the woman already has with the child. It's the same thing. It's the same, you're not going to bite me, you're not going to tear at me. We've got to be in a state of mutual trust, because we're here because we're both enjoying it. Because nature, in a way, has given us this little space which is extremely enjoyable for both of us. But in order for it to be enjoyable, we have to put all that other competitive stuff aside and just surrender ourselves to the pleasure of being together. And we started to expand that. And particularly the woman, because the man's ready, right? He was already ready. It's the woman that expands it, and the sense being from him that the woman is expanding that because the woman, in a way, is bringing the man into her loving space.
Do you know no male primates have a rut?
They don't go into season. No male.
No, I think the males are ready all the time. In the,
I know with a lot of mammals.
No, in the primate. I haven't studied primate sexuality. I'm getting this purely from the book. So remember, this isn't my area, although it's quite an interesting area. I get more interested in it when I read about it. So that form of sexuality was a prolongation of the mother-child love connection, but it starts to form now between adolescent boys and girls. They carry on their childhood intimacy with each other as children and with their mother. They carried on into their as they reach sexual maturity, and they start to find this is fun, right? This is enjoyable, but that starts to channel or canal a certain space, you know, loving space, where language can develop. So it isn't just developing with the children; it's developing between the man and the woman. Now I have to explain something from the. Just to add to this story, because it's a good myth. Remembering it's a myth. So there is an out. You know, there's a splitting of the ways in more recent history, where this patriarchal, male-dominated, competitive form of civilization starts to take off. And we're looking at the hunter-gatherers. This is hunter-gatherer world that developed us. Right, that's the civil. That's the culture that developed our bodies, our modes of behaviour, our ability to speak. This is later in the book, so I'm just adding this. They are theorising that what happened essentially is that the hunter gatherer males were exterminated, and the women were assimilated into the patriarchal culture. So that's not to say that way of living for the male disappeared, but here I have to go to Rupert Sheldrake. I don't know how many of you are familiar with Rupert Sheldrake. Morphic resonance. I'm inclined to accept morphic resonance, which says that any form of behaviour, once it's been repeated sufficiently, remains accessible to the species, even if the lineage is like that is virtually exterminated. It's still an accessible form of behaviour should you start to engage in it again. Yes, it's more accessible to you than if it was never engaged in before. So it's not that that those original males who were part of that lineage, it was irrevocably lost. The behaviour had been made, if you like, in the human psyche. And the thinking, Maturana's thinking here, and Gerda Verdensöller, is that the women, the hunter-gatherer women, formed a kind of subculture in the patriarchy that attempted to keep this former way of life alive. Now, in a way, I'm referring this back to my own life. This is like my mum, in a way. She was keeping, not, and it's not that she doesn't know any of this, right? It's in the species. It's not that you have to know. Oh, yeah, I'm keeping this form of life alive in the midst of this dreadful patriarchy. It's the kind of thing. If you engage in it, then it recurs. It lives again.
Just have to rub it.
unfortunate use of language, Alec, but. But certainly, you know, because that's been my... I hope you don't mind me bringing it back to my life, because in a way, the only confirmation of this is in your own experience. But that... in my own life, I've had to be brought back to a loving way of being, not just through with my mum, but with Nicolette. You know, it's almost like something has there. I feel that sexuality of the what we might call the that lineage it's in me, right? It's a presence. It's a psychic presence, and if I engage in it, I become it. You know, a bit like being the dean. If I want to be a predatory sexual male who treats a woman as an object, that mode of behaviour, you know, the door's right next door to me, right? I just need to open the handle and you're in. You know, it's like our evolutionary history of the behaviours that we've engaged in. They're all sitting there.
It's like Walt in Breaking Bad.
Is it? I watched Breaking Bad for about 3 episodes, and then it was starting to get too much for
really
me.
Good, but he starts off as a mild-mannered teacher, and then he just becomes this monster. And the whole way through, I was going, "No, there's no way he's going to become a poor Walt." And it works so well, like how he just became this self-involved person.
Yes,
it's not as a person. He's not becoming horrible as a person. He's just what he's doing is.
But that consumes him. So he has this kind of. This imaginary self with his family, but that's all gone. You know, he thinks he's all the good dad, and all, but that's
yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
That's obviously spoilerizing if you say.
Yeah.
But he gets consumed by that identity, which isn't him at all at the start.
He becomes like the dean of the drug war, so
yeah.
He is becoming, you know, power is
yeah.
overpowering.
Yeah.
Once you obtain power, it's
yeah.
taking over you. That's
and
the trap,
that he
isn't
thinks
it? Of
justified.
Any progression, but. But in a way, you can still see that he's, you know, fundamentally, he's not there to.
Perhaps I need to
his
see.
His ego just goes.
Yeah.
He's trying good.
Just
the music's good.
Yeah, yes. It's quite heavy going. And are you? I have to say.
It's like the opposite, though. Most of his life beforehand was like so submissive. At the end, he became so dominant. So it's almost like a psychical thing. What happened to it?
I think he regains control of his
But you have to be.
Yeah, it's
like,
true. It was the resentment was all there, and then it
just
came out.
Yeah, you made
the power, and he was away.
Oh, you resented not having the power, and then when he gets the power, he just full steam ahead. Is that what you're telling me at?
I'm not saying what happens later on. You have to watch.
Oh, you will.
Oh,
yes. To which I have to. I have to add a kind of corollary, and I'm thinking of Gurdjieff again. You know, whatever you watch in the media is food. It's food. It's just the same as eating a really bad meal. I'm not saying Breaking Bad.
Quality
as well, but I guess for me I avoid watching violence because I understand it's a certain level you appreciate it aesthetically, but there's another level where your emotional level doesn't know the difference.
Yeah.
Do you know?
Yeah.
I had to. It was Game of Thrones I was watching. I had to stop watching because then it's an emotional reaction. I thought I need to reserve this for real life things rather than something virtual.
Yes.
And unreal.
Actually,
yeah.
I stopped watching all Hollywood movies. I stopped.
I can't watch a horror film.
In my early 20s.
Yeah.
And now when I see it, I was like, I can see why.
Watching what?
I start watching films in general.
Oh, war films.
Yeah. Sometimes I know. Yeah, I still watch a lot of films, but. I can see the propaganda. I can see all the. It's disgusting.
And however fine you think your consciousness is, you know, I can watch this because I know what they're doing. I can see what they're doing. There's a level there that doesn't. That just sucks it. Sucks it in. And it'll be in your dreams that night. It'll be in a mood you wake up with in the morning. It's all very.
Yeah, I think it depends on the context of it, of how it's being.
It depends on whether. The thing has a hook in your particular psyche, actually. I think some people, it doesn't disturb you because the hook isn't there. It's
some things that would disturb me, there's the things where the violence is not for any reason. And when my kids were tiny,
I could not watch most things, and particularly anything with harm being done to a child or just violence. I just, we didn't watch any adult films for years and years and years for fear of there being. And now we've gone hard again. So.
Yeah, yeah.
So what about the argument though that, I mean, like the Greek dramatists, they would enact, like Medea, she killed her own children.
Yes.
The idea was that this was to enable the audience to experience catharsis, so that you can go through emotions that are far too big and horrible to experience in your real life, and you can expunge them through watching this drama.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, I've been to quite a few Greek dramas, and you know, you do kind of come out like this, and it somehow, but it doesn't make me. It's not the same effect as watching a really horrible, nasty.
Yes.
No,
but there's an aspect here where life is tragic.
Mm.
There's a tragic dimension to life,
mm.
and really good drama, and it's only in later life I've been able to handle this, can express the tragic dimension of life.
Mm.
But that's different. You don't have to see the guts spilled on the pavement. It's when it becomes
emotional.
When it becomes graphic, that it's just shocking to the it's, you know, it's like if you witness something like that, it reverberates in you. The part of you, when you're seeing on TV, it reverberates.
But you're not saying don't watch anything.
I'm giving no injunctions, Kev.
You're
just
not saying that you would feel that it was damaging you to go and see something like Medea or something.
No. No.
Human dramas are kind of played out.
No, and a lot of the Shakespeare dramas, tragedies, you know, I've seen that they are saying something about the human psyche.
Yes.
You know, they're just it's a showing you as it is. And I know we're digressing here, but there's a strange line there, isn't there? But it has to be extraordinarily fine art to do that, and I don't see a lot of that on the TV. Occasionally, I do. I think the last thing I saw like that was Mother, Father, Son. I don't know if you saw that, about the Richard Gere playing a kind of Rupert Murdoch character. And the utter catastrophe of his family, and it was harrowing drama.
Mm-hmm.
But you say, "Oh, John, why did you watch that?" You know. But I got what you
mm-hmm.
got out of that. I thought, mm-hmm. "Oh, yeah, the intent here is to show something of how it is." You know, when the intent's there to do that, but it's very you've got a lot of people think they're doing that. But they're not seeing how it is. It's such a fine thing to, because everybody thinks they see things as, you know, everyone thinks they're right, don't they? That's the tragedy of the human race. So I know I'm not. There's no. This is no possibility of me getting through this lecture. Do you think I should throw the towel in now?
Yeah.
Yes.
Well,
it must be 25 to 3 now. So I will attempt to finish this lecture next week and give you another reading. Yes?
Yeah.
Are you giving us another reading for next week, or are you going to read this?
Well, those of you who didn't read this have got two readings.
Oh,